Hi, I'm Rick Steves, and I consider myself very lucky to be part of the public radio family. Each week on Travel with Rick Steves, I get to expand my view of this planet and the events that shape how we live today. Talking with some of the most fascinating travelers anywhere each week helps bring complicated things into focus. Right now, let's meet travel guide Mark Seymour. Mark's a Brit who now makes his home in northwestern France, in the part of Europe that was violently contested territory back in the 14th and 15th centuries, as England and France battled for dominance in the Hundred Years' War. And according to Mark, a single piece of technology, the weapon we call the longbow, played a decisive role in determining not only the modern map of Europe, but perhaps even the language I'm speaking right now. Mark, what's the big deal about the longbow?
I don't think you can overstate the impression that the longbow had on our medieval history.
How so?
In the 1200s, a man called Edward I, was rampaging through Wales. The lands that are now called Wales, he's unified and brought under the English flag. He discovered that there were people up in those hills that were using this weapon, a piece of stick, with another piece of stick, with a piece of string, and they would use it for game hunting. And he thought, this is pretty impressive. It's a long-range weapon. I need that.
Is this a unique bow and arrow, or are we just talking about a bow and arrow?
It's a six-foot-long piece of yew.
So this is not just a bow and arrow like we made when we were kids.
He decided that he could recruit some of these people. Many, many Welshmen fought in the English armies in Wales. He made it a big part of the British military. When we reached the period of the Hundred Years' War, of course, the armies in Britain were much smaller than continental armies could be. We had a small population. There was not a lot of money. The English throne was poor. It was bankrupt compared to French throne.
And France and England were embroiled in this 100-years-long war.
Fought totally in France, yeah. It was the English kingdoms at the time, they owned vast lands, extensive lands all the way around what is now North and West France.
Was it basically a squabble over who owns what because of this king and that king succeeded another and there was a question about who was the rightful king?
That's how it started, and then it was protracted because, you know, who should be king of France? Should it be the king of England or should it be the king of France?
But at one time, I mean, half of today's France was considered part of England.
That's right, absolutely.
So France is in the hole, France is fighting. England has a smaller army, though.
Well, a much smaller army, much smaller population. Population between 2 and 3 million people. In France, the population of the French territories were approximately 15 to 16 million people. So we needed an edge. They attacked our lands, and we needed an edge to defend them.
They attacked your lands in France.
Okay,
so they were your
France,
lands.
What
you
became
English
France,
people.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
And the English, outnumbered, defended themselves against great odds with their secret weapon,
yes.
The longbow.
Yes. And Edward was a very clever man. Going way back to the 1200s, he had actually instituted a law whereby every Englishman between the age of 15 and 60 would own a longbow.
Wow.
And weapons. No matter how poor you were, you would have to have this weapon. 30 years later, he instituted another law, which meant that these men had to go and train for 10 hours a day once a week. So by the time the Hundred Years' War came along, 100 years later...
We're talking, what, in the 1300s, basically.
Exactly, yeah.
Could anybody make a longbow? I mean, any peasant with a carving knife could make a longbow? Or did you need special wood to have such a powerful bow?
Anybody and everybody who owned a bow would be able to make one, but they did need special wood. They needed the heart of the yew tree.
The heart of the yew tree?
Yes.
Oh, so that would be quite expensive, actually, when you get to the heart of a yew tree.
Yes, yes. And as the Hundred Years' War wore on, yew became almost inaccessible to most people because the trees had been felled. You know, 100 years of warfare, everybody using
so
a bow.
So the yew was endangered because that's where you had your most powerful weapon.
Yes.
And by the heart, you mean the very inside of the trunk of the yew.
The inside. And then the outer bark around it that creates that strength and the spring. And that's what gives a bow the power. Now, depending on how powerful you are, it would depend on how thick that bow should be and how tall it should be.
So if you had a very strong man, you could have a very big bow, but
very
it was still
bow.
Limited to what one man could pull back with his arm.
Yes.
Long story short, who won the Hundred Years' War and how might have history been different if we didn't have the longbow involved?
Well, I'm English, so I'll always make a joke of it. We won most of the battles. The French did win the war.
Because that's where we have France today.
Exactly,
the way it is.
Exactly.
But you lost the war, but you had the advantage with the longbow. So how could the longbow have made a difference today? Did it stop France from going further?
Yes, and I think because it checked France for that 140-year period, it stopped them from becoming the great power in Europe. And in fact, it's quite interesting because the Holy Roman Empire itself actually backed England at the beginning of the Hundred Years' War. So they recognized the ability of France to stretch its wings and perhaps prosper too much.
Could you actually say that if there was no longbow, we might be having this interview in French today?
Yes, yeah, I think that's perfectly fair to say. I think that is quite likely.
That is something that, given how well I speak French, I'm glad there was a longbow.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that one.
And as a traveler, where can I best see Hundred Years' War sites?
In France, obviously, because of that war. Mm-hmm. That's where it was fought. One of the best is Mont-Saint-Michel. You can still see the walls. You can still see the artillery. There's a piece inside the gate there at Mont-Saint-Michel.
At Mont-Saint-Michel, from the 14th century, from the Hundred Years' War.
It's an English piece of cannon that we were unable to take the island.
But how did the longbow even matter? Does it impact history later on? Are we different today because of the longbow?
Some famous battles were won during the Hundred Years' War, courtesy of the longbow. The English archers, it's reputed if they were captured, their fingers would be removed.
Wait a minute. The archers, when they would capture them, because they were the key guys, these were the most destructive guys on the enemy team.
Yes.
To make them unable to fight in the future, rather than killing them, they could just cut off the fingers that they pulled the bow with?
Yes. The story goes that the fingers would be removed. To this day, now, if you think back to the Second World War, the end of the Second World War, Churchill did a wonderful sign. He put the two fingers up, the V. And to this day, an Englishman will always use that sign as a sign for victory.
I thought it was like V worldwide. For the letter V for victory, but it's V for I still have my fingers.
I still have my two fingers, yes.
The fingers I use to pull back the string on that longbow.
The English longbow, yes. The resilience of the English nation reflected in two fingers.
I never get tired of learning from guests like Mark Seymour or from the insights I gain from my own travels. That's also how I feel about public radio. I start almost every day with a little public radio. It's a routine I treasure. The programming on my local station connects me with our world, here at home and to the far corners. And that's what we like to do with our program, Travel with Rick Steves. I've found that sometimes our travels teach us as much about ourselves as they do about the places we visit. That was the case for Christopher Solomon, who set off to explore one of the most remote places on Earth, Aniakchak National Monument in southwestern Alaska. There are no trails, no park rangers, and a lot more bears than humans. Christopher wrote about Aniakchak in an article for Outside Magazine. In your article, you wrote, "The colors are always brighter if a place draws a little blood first." That's a fascinating observation. Tell us a little more about that.
There's a wonderful, incredibly legendary mountaineer named Fred Becky, and he once said in a book about the North Cascades in Washington State that beauty is paid for partly in the currency of suffering. What I've always loved about that is I think there's something about working hard to get somewhere that sharpens the experience once you've made it.
Oh, and you appreciate it more. If you climb to a peak or if you're dropped there by a helicopter, it's beautiful either way. But one way you earn it and you probably savor it a little differently.
And I suppose there's a tipping point in which this no longer applies so well, or diminishing returns. But in some sense, you never forget the times that you'd rather not remember at some point.
that's true. It's that's in the retrospect, at a minimum, it's a beautiful experience. You also wrote in a different article, but I just love the way you write about wilderness experiences. You're on another Alaskan adventure, and you wrote, "I'll admit, too, to enjoying the fear that can accompany such seclusion." You wrote, "Friends and I spent days fishing at a fly-in forest service cabin on Martin Lake in Copper River Delta outside Cordova, Alaska." And you wrote, "I still remember the afternoon we stood in the lake and hauled in a huge trout, only to see a very large brown bear squinting at us from the shore as if gauging whether we were worth the effort. He left tracks larger than coffee cans and snuffled through our dreams all night." So you're laying there thinking that that bear knew where you were and he already sussed you out. "There are few thrills that can quite match the electric prickle on the neck that comes with knowing one no longer stands atop the food chain." Tell me more about that feeling when you're out in the middle of nowhere and you realize you're no longer top on the food chain.
I was thinking about this a lot in Aniakchak, where in the crater there were bear tracks the size of garden rakes.
And there was no service. You couldn't dial 911.
Oh, no. We had a sat phone for emergencies, but they would never get there. They'd get there in time to sweep up your remains if they could find any. I think what I like, Rick, is that when you realize that you're a potential crudité, it hones your sense of where you are. And you're very aware of your surroundings. And either you like that prickle on the back of the neck or you don't like it. And within reason, if I've taken the right precautions, I like it a great deal.
That's Christopher Solomon telling us about his experience among the bears and the lonely natural beauty of Aniakchak National Monument in Alaska. Only a few dozen people reach Aniakchak each year, which means you probably haven't been there. I certainly haven't. That's why I'm so dedicated to this radio show, because it takes me and you to places outside our everyday comfort zone. And it's only possible through public radio. This station provides a way for us, together, to explore our complicated and beautiful planet. When you call in to support public radio, you're helping to ensure that your entire community gets to come along with us on this journey. When you help fund your local station with your contribution, we all get a little more worldly. Your neighbors become better informed, and you'll find that you're living in a more enlightened, thoughtful community as a result. That alone is worth a lot. Public radio gives us perspectives on the world that you just don't find anywhere else. With your financial support for this station, Travel with Rick Steves is able to return each week to keep bringing you these adventures. Let's keep traveling and getting smarter together. Thanks a lot for doing your part.